This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. A few dozen friends of mine gave me a wonderful Christmas present. They each recorded some Christmas stories for me to broadcast. These run the gamut from spiritual to funny, from touching to shocking to scary. We got some sci-fi, we've got some poetry, there are some songs and some jokes. Robin Bullock supplied the instrumental music. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience.
Hi, my name is Mark Anderson, and I will be reading a story called Barrington Bunny by Martin Bell. It's a Christmas parable. Once upon a time, in a large forest, there lived a very furry bunny. He had one lop ear, a tiny black nose, and unusually shiny eyes. His name was Barrington. Barrington was not a really very handsome bunny. He was brown and speckled, and his ears didn't stand upright. But he could hop, and he was, as I have said, very furry. In a way, winter is fun for bunnies. After all, it gives them an opportunity to hop in the snow and then turn around and see where they have hopped. So in a way, winter was fun for Barrington. But in another way, winter made Barrington sad. For you see, winter marked the time when all of the animal families got together in their cozy homes to celebrate Christmas. He could hop, and he was very furry. But as far as Barrington knew, he was the only bunny in the forest. When Christmas Eve finally came, Barrington did not feel like going home all by himself. So he decided that he would hop for a while in the clearing in the center of the forest. Hop, hop, hippity hop. Barrington made tracks in the fresh snow. Hop, hop, hippity hop. Then he cocked his head and looked back at the wonderful designs he had made. Bunnies, he thought to himself, can hop, and they are very warm, too, because of how furry they are. But Barrington didn't really know whether or not this was true of all bunnies, well, since he had never met another bunny. When it got too dark to see the tracks he was making, Barrington made up his mind to go home. On his way, however, he passed a large oak tree. High in the branches, there was a great deal of excited chattering going on. Barrington looked up. It was a squirrel family. What a marvelous time they seemed to be having. "Hello up there," called Barrington.
"Hello down there," came the reply.
"Having a Christmas party?" asked Barrington.
"Oh, yes," answered the squirrels. "It's Christmas Eve. Everybody is having a Christmas party."
"May I come to your party?" said Barrington softly.
"Are you a squirrel?"
"No."
"What are you then?"
"A bunny."
"A bunny?"
"Well, yes."
"Well, how can you come to the party if you're a bunny? Bunnies can't climb trees."
"Well, that's true," said Barrington thoughtfully. "But I can hop, and I'm very furry and warm."
"We're sorry," called the squirrels. "We don't know anything about hopping and being furry, but we do know that in order to come to our house, you have to be able to climb trees."
"Oh, well," said Barrington. "Merry Christmas."
"Merry Christmas," chattered the squirrels.
And the unfortunate bunny hopped off toward his tiny house. It was beginning to snow when Barrington reached the river. Near the river bank was a wonderful constructed house of sticks and mud. Inside, he could hear singing. "It's the beavers," thought Barrington. "Maybe they will let me come to their party." And so he knocked on the door.
"Who's out there?" called a voice.
"Oh, Barrington Bunny," he replied.
There was a long pause, and then a shiny beaver head broke the water.
"Hello, Barrington," said the beaver.
"May I come to your Christmas party?" asked Barrington. The beaver thought for a while, and then he said,
"I suppose so. Do you know how to swim?"
"No," said Barrington, "but I can hop, and I am very furry and warm."
"Sorry," said the beaver. "I don't know anything about hopping and being furry, but I do know that in order to come to our house, you have to be able to swim."
"Oh, well," Barrington muttered, his eyes filling with tears. "I suppose that's true. Merry Christmas."
"Merry Christmas," called the beaver, and he disappeared beneath the surface of the water. Even being as furry as he was, Barrington was beginning to get cold, and the snow was falling so hard that his tiny bunny eyes could scarcely see what was ahead of him. He was almost home, however, when he heard the excited squeaking of field mice beneath the ground. "It's a party," thought Barrington. And suddenly he blurted out through his tears, "Hello, field mice. This is Barrington Bunny. May I come to your party?" But the wind was howling so loudly, and Barrington was sobbing so much that no one heard him. And when there was no response at all, Barrington just sat down in the snow and began to cry with all his might. "Bunnies," he thought, "aren't good to anyone. What good is it to be furry and to be able to hop if you don't even have any family on Christmas Eve?" Barrington cried and cried. When he stopped crying, he began to bite on his bunny's foot, but he did not move from where he was sitting in the snow. Suddenly, Barrington was aware that he was not alone. He looked up and strained his shiny eyes to see who was there. To his surprise, he saw a great silver wolf. The wolf was large and strong, and his eyes flashed fire. He was the most beautiful animal Barrington had ever seen. For a long time, the silver wolf didn't say anything at all. He just stood there and looked at Barrington with those terrible eyes. Then slowly and deliberately, the wolf spoke. "Barrington," he said in a gentle voice, "why are you sitting in the snow?"
"Because it's Christmas Eve," said Barrington, "and I don't have any family, and bunnies aren't any good to anyone."
"Bunnies are too good," said the wolf. "Bunnies can hop, and they are very warm."
"Oh, what good is that?" Barrington sniffed.
"It is very good indeed," the wolf went on, "because it is a gift that bunnies are given, a free gift, with no strings attached. And every gift that is given to anyone is given for a reason. Some day you will see why it is good to hop and to be warm and furry."
"But it's Christmas," moaned Barrington, "and I'm all alone. I don't have any family at all."
"Of course you do," replied the great silver wolf. "All of the animals in the forest are your family." And then the wolf disappeared. He simply wasn't there. Barrington had only blinked his eyes, and when he looked, the wolf was gone. "All of the animals in the forest are my family," thought Barrington. "It's good to be a bunny. Bunnies can hop. That's a gift." And then he said it again. "A gift. A free gift." On into the night, Barrington worked. First, he found the best stick that he could, and that was difficult because of all the snow. Then hop, hop, hippity hop, to the beaver's house. He left the stick just outside the door, with a note on it that read, "Here is a good stick for your house. It is a gift, a free gift, no strings attached. Signed, a member of your family." "It is a good thing that I can hop," he thought, "because the snow is very deep." Well, then Barrington dug and dug. Soon he had gathered enough dead leaves and grass to make the squirrel's nest warmer. Hop, hop, hippity hop. He laid the grass and leaves just under the large oak tree and attached this message. "A gift, a free gift, from a member of your family." It was late when Barrington finally started home, and what made things worse was that he knew a blizzard was beginning. Hop, hop, hippity hop. Soon poor Barrington was lost. The wind howled furiously, and he was very, very cold.
"It certainly is cold," he said out loud. "It's a good thing I'm so furry, but if I don't find my way home pretty soon, even I might freeze."
"Squeak! Squeak!"
And then he saw it. A baby field mouse lost in the snow. And the little mouse was crying. "Hello, little mouse," Barrington called. "Oh, don't cry. I'll be right there." Hippity-hop, and Barrington was beside the tiny mouse.
"I'm lost," sobbed the little fellow. "I'll never find my way home, and I know I'm going to freeze."
"You won't freeze," said Barrington. "I'm a bunny, and bunnies are very furry and warm. You stay right where you are, and I'll cover you." Barrington lay on top of the little mouse and hugged him tight. The tiny fellow felt himself surrounded by warm fur. He cried for a while, but soon, snug and warm, he fell asleep. Barrington had only two thoughts that long, cold night. First, he thought, "It's good to be a bunny. Bunnies are very furry and warm." And then, when he felt the heart of the tiny mouse beneath him beating regularly, he thought, "All of the animals in the forest are my family." Next morning, the field mice found their little boy asleep in the snow, warm and snug, beneath the furry carcass of a dead bunny. Their relief and excitement was so great, they didn't even think to question where the bunny had come from. And as for the beavers and the squirrels, they still wonder which member of their family left the little gifts for them that Christmas Eve. After the field mice had left, Barrington's frozen body simply lay in the snow. There was no sound except that of the howling wind, and no one anywhere in the forest noticed the great silver wolf who came to stand beside that brown, lop-eared carcass. But the wolf did come. And he stood there, without moving or saying a word, all Christmas Day, until it was night. And then he disappeared again into the forest.
This is Heather Boggs, and I'll be reading The Burglar's Christmas by Willa Cather. Two very shabby-looking young men stood at the corner of Prairie Avenue and 80th Street, looking despondently at the carriages that whirled by. It was Christmas Eve, and the streets were full of vehicles, florist wagons, grocers' carts, and carriages. The streets were in that half-liquid, half-congealed condition peculiar to the streets of Chicago at that season of the year. The swift wheels that spun by sometimes through the slush of mud and snow over the two young men who were talking on the corner. "Well," remarked the elder of the two, "I guess we are at our rope's end, sure enough. How do you feel?" "Pretty shaky. The wind's sharp tonight. If I had anything to eat, I mightn't mind it so much. There is simply no show. I'm sick of the whole business. Looks like there's nothing for it but the lake." "Oh, nonsense. I thought you had more grit. Got anything left you can hawk?" "Nothing but my beard, and I'm afraid they wouldn't find it worth a pawn ticket," says the younger man ruefully, rubbing the week's growth of stubble on his face. "Got any folks anywhere? Now's your time to strike 'em if you have." "Never mind if I have. They're out of the question." "Well, you'll be out of it before many hours if you don't make a move of some sort. A man's got to eat. See here, I am going down to Long Tin Saloon. I used to play the banjo in there with a couple of coons, and I'll bone him for some of his free lunch stuff. You'd better come along. Perhaps they'll fill an order for two." "How far down is it?" "Well, it's clear downtown, of course, way down on Michigan Avenue. Thanks. I guess I'll loaf around here. I don't feel equal to the walk, and the cars, well, the cars are crowded. His features drew themselves into what might have been a smile under happier circumstances. No, you never did like streetcars. You're too aristocratic. See here, Crawford, I don't like leaving you here. You ain't good company for yourself tonight. Crawford? Oh, yes, that's the last one. There have been so many, I forget them. Have you got a real name anyway? Oh, yes, but it's one of the ones I've forgotten. Don't you worry about me. You go along and get your free lunch. I think I had a row in Longton's place once. I better not show myself there again. As he spoke, the young man nodded and turned slowly up the avenue. He was miserable enough to want to be quite alone. Even the crowd that jostled by him annoyed him. He wanted to think about himself. He had avoided this final reckoning with himself for a year now. He had laughed it off and drunk it off. But now, when all those artificial devices which are employed to turn our thoughts into other channels and shield us from ourselves had failed him, it must come. Hunger is a powerful incentive to introspection. It is a tragic hour, that hour when we are finally driven to reckon with ourselves, when every avenue of mental distraction has been cut off and our own life and all its ineffaceable failures closes about us like the walls of that old torture chamber of the Inquisition. Tonight, as this man stood stranded in the streets of the city, his hour came. It was not the first time he had been hungry and desperate and alone, but always before there had been some outlook, some chance ahead, some pleasure yet untasted that seemed worth the effort, some face that he fancied was or would be dear. But it was not so tonight. The unyielding conviction was upon him that he had failed in everything, had outlived everything. It had been near him for a long time, that pale specter. He had been caught in its shadow at the bottom of his glass many a time, at the head of his bed when he was sleepless at night, in the twilight shadows when some great sunset broke upon him. It had made life hateful to him when he awoke in the morning, before now. But now it settled slowly over him like night, the endless northern nights that bid the sun a long farewell. It rose up before him like granite. From this brilliant city with its glad bustle of Yuletide, he was shut off as completely as though he were a creature of another species. His days seemed numbered and done, sealed over like the little coral cells at the bottom of the sea. Involuntarily, he drew that cold air through his lungs slowly, as though he were tasting it for the last time. Yet he was but 24, this man. He looked even younger, and he had a father someplace down east who had been very proud of him once. Well, he had taken his life into his own hands, and this was what he had made of it. That was all there was to be said. He could remember the hopeful things they used to say about him at college in the old days, before he had cut away and begun to live by his wits, and he found courage to smile at them now. They had read him wrongly. He knew now that he never had the essentials of success, only the superficial agility that is often mistaken for it. He was tow without the tinder, and he had burnt himself out at other people's fires. He had helped other people to make it win, but he himself, he had never touched an enterprise that had not failed eventually. Or if it survived his connection with it, it left him behind. His last venture had been with some 10-cent specialty company, a little lower than all the others, that had gone to pieces in Buffalo, and he had worked his way to Chicago by boat. When the boat made up its crew for its outward voyage, he was dispensed with as usual. He was used to that. The reason for it? Oh, There are so many reasons for failure. His was a very common one. As he stood there in the wet under the streetlight, he drew up his reckonings with the world and decided that it had treated him as well as he deserved. He had overdrawn his account once too often. There had been a day when he thought otherwise, when he had said he was unjustly handled, that his failure was merely the lack of proper adjustment between himself and other men, that someday he would be recognized and it would all come right. But he knew better than that now, and he was still man enough to bear no grudge against anyone, man or woman. Tonight was his birthday, too. There seemed something particularly amusing in that. He turned up a limp little coat collar to try to keep a little of the wet chill from his throat and instinctively began to remember all of the birthday parties he used to have. He was so cold and empty that his mind seemed unable to grapple with any serious question. He kept thinking about gingerbread and frosted cakes like a child. He could remember the splendid birthday parties his mother used to give him when all of the other little boys in the block came in their Sunday clothes and creaking shoes, with their ears still red from their mother's towel, and the pink and white birthday cake, and the stuffed olives, and all of the dishes of which he had been particularly fond, and how he would eat and eat and eat, and then go to bed and dream of Santa Claus. And in the morning he would awaken and eat again, until by night the family doctor arrived with his castor oil, and poor William used to dolefully say that it was altogether too much to have your birthday and Christmas all at once. He could remember, too, the royal birthday suppers he had given at college, and the stag dinners and the toasts, and the music and the good fellows who had wished him happiness and really meant what they said. And since then, there were other birthday suppers that he could not remember so clearly. The memory of them was heavy and flat, like cigarette smoke that had been shut in a room all night, like champagne that had been a day opened, a song that has been too often sung, an acute sensation that has been overstrained. They seemed tawdry and garish, discordant to him now. He rather wished he could forget them altogether. Whichever way his mind now turned, there was one thought that he could not escape, and that was the idea of food. He caught the scent of a cigar suddenly and felt a sharp pain in the pit of his abdomen and a sudden moisture in his mouth. His cold hands clenched angrily, and for a moment he felt that bitter hatred of wealth, of ease, of everything that is well-fed and well-housed that is common to starving men. At any rate, he had a right to eat. He had demanded great things from the world once, fame and wealth and admiration. Now it was simply bread, and he would have it. He looked about him quickly and felt the blood beginning to stir in his veins. In all his straits, he had never stolen anything. His tastes were above it. But tonight, there would be no tomorrow. He was amused at the way in which the idea excited him. Was it possible there was yet one more experience that would distract him, one thing that had power to excite his jaded interest? Good! He had failed at everything else. Now he would see what his chances would be as a common thief. It would be amusing to watch this beautiful consistency of his destiny work itself out even in that role. It would be interesting to add another study to his gallery of futile attempts and then label them all the failure as a journalist, the failure as a lecturer, the failure as a businessman, the failure as a thief, and so on, like the titles under the pictures of the Dance of Death. It was time that Child Roland came to the Dark Tower. A girl hastened by him with her arms full of packages. She walked quickly and nervously, keeping well within the shadows, as if she were not accustomed to carrying bundles and did not care to meet any of her friends. As she crossed the muddy street, she made an effort to lift her skirt a little, and as she did so, one of the packages slipped unnoticed from beneath her arm. He caught it up and overtook her. "Excuse me, but I think you dropped something." She started. "Oh, yes, thank you. I would rather have lost anything than that." The young man turned angrily upon himself. The package must have contained something of value. Why had he not kept it? Was this the sort of thief he would make? He ground his teeth together. There is nothing more maddening than to have morally consented to crime and then lack the nerve force to carry it out. A carriage drove up to the house before which he stood. Several richly dressed women alighted and went in. It was a new house and must have been built since he was in Chicago last. The front door was open, and he could see down the hallway and up the staircase. The servant had left the door and gone with the guests. The first floor was brilliantly lighted, but the window upstairs were dark. It looked very easy just to slip upstairs to the darkened chambers where the jewels and trinkets of the fashionable occupants were kept. Still burning with impatience against himself, he entered quickly. Instinctively, he removed his mud-stained hat as he passed quickly and quietly up the staircase. It struck him as being a rather superfluous courtesy in a burglar, but he had done it before he had thought. His way was clear enough. He met no one on the stairway or up in the upper hall. The gas was lit in the upper hall. He passed the first chamber door through sheer cowardice. The second he entered quickly, thinking of something else, lest his courage should fail him, and closed the door behind him. The light from the hall shone into the room through the transom. The apartment was furnished richly enough to justify his expectations. He went at once to the dressing case. A number of rings and small trinkets lay in a silver tray. These he put hastily in his pocket. He opened the upper drawer and found, as he expected, several leather cases. In the first he opened was a lady's watch, in the second a pair of old-fashioned bracelets. He seemed to dimly remember having seen bracelets like them before, somewhere. The third case was heavier, the spring was much more worn, and it opened easily. It held a cup of some kind. He held it up to the light, and then his strained nerves gave way and he uttered a sharp exclamation. It was the silver mug he used to drink from when he was a little boy. The door opened, and a woman stood in the doorway facing him. She was a tall woman with white hair and an evening dress. The light from the hall streamed in upon him, but she was not afraid. She stood, looking at him, a moment, then she threw out her hand and went quickly toward him. "Willie? Willie? Is it you?" He struggled to loose her arms from him, to keep her lips from his cheek. "Mother! You must not. You do not understand. Oh, my God, this is worst of all." Hunger, weakness, cold, shame, all came back to him and shook his self-control completely. Physically, he was too weak to stand a shock like this. Why could it have not been an ordinary discovery, arrest, the station house, and all the rest of it? Anything but this. A hard, dry sob broke from him. Again, he strove to disengage himself. "Who is it says I shall not kiss my son? Oh, my boy, we have waited so long for this. You have been so long in coming. Even I almost gave you up." Her lips upon his cheek burnt him like fire. He put his hand to his throat and spoke thickly and incoherently. You do not understand. I did not know you were here. I came here to rob. It is the first time, I swear it, but I am a common thief. My pockets are full of your jewels now. Can't you hear me? I am a common thief. Hush, my boy. Those are ugly words. How could you rob your own house? How could you take what is yours? They are all yours, my son, as wholly yours as my great love. And you can't doubt that, Will, do you? That soft voice, the warmth and fragrance of her person, stole through his chill, empty veins like a gentle stimulant. He felt as though all his strength were leaving him, and even consciousness. He held fast to her and bowed his head on her strong shoulder and groaned aloud, "Oh, mother, life is hard, hard." She said nothing but held him closer. And oh, the strength of those white arms that held him. Oh, the assurance of safety in that warm bosom that rose and fell under his cheek. For a moment they stood so, silently. Then they heard a heavy step upon the stair. She led him to a chair and went out and closed the door. At the top of the staircase, she met a tall, broad-shouldered man with iron-gray hair and a face alert and stern. Her eyes were shining and her cheeks on fire. Her whole face was one expression of intense determination. James, it is William in there. Come home. You must keep him at any cost. If he goes this time, I go with him. Oh, James, be easy with him. He has suffered so. She broke from a command to an entreaty and laid her hand on his shoulder. He looked questioningly at her a moment, then went into the room and quietly shut the door. She stood leaning against the wall, clasping her temples with her hands and listening to the low, indistinct sound of the voices within. Her own lips moved silently. She waited a long time, scarcely breathing. At last the door opened, and her husband came out. He stopped to say in a shaken voice, "You go to him now. He will stay. I will go to my room. I will see him again in the morning." She put her arm around his neck. "Oh, James, I thank you. I thank you. This is the night he came so long ago. You remember? I gave him to you then, and now you give him back to me." "Don't, Helen," he muttered. "He is my son. I have never forgotten that. I failed with him. I don't like to fail. It cuts my pride. Take him and make a man of him." He passed on down the hall. She flew into the room where the young man sat with his head bowed upon his knee. She dropped upon her knees beside him. Ah, it was so good to him to feel those arms again. "He is so glad, Willie, so glad. He may not show it, but he is as happy as I. He never was demonstrative with either of us, you know." "Oh, my God, he was good enough," groaned the man. "I told him everything, and he was good enough. I don't see how either of you can look at me, speak to me, touch me." He shivered under her clasp again, as when she had first touched him, and tried weakly to throw her off. But she whispered softly, "This is my right, my son." Presently, when he was calmer, she rose. "Now come with me into the library, and I will have your dinner brought there." As they went downstairs, she remarked apologetically, "I will not call Ellen tonight. She has a number of guests to attend to. She is a big girl now, you know, and came out last winter. Besides, I want you all to myself tonight." When the dinner came, and it came very soon, he fell upon it savagely. As he ate, she told him all that had transpired during the years of his absence, and how his father's business had brought them there. "I was glad when we came. I thought you would drift west. I seemed a good deal nearer to you here." There was a gentle, unobtrusive sadness in her tone that was too soft for a reproach. "Have you everything you want? It is a comfort to see you eat." He smiled grimly. "It is certainly a comfort to me. I have not indulged in this frivolous habit for some 35 hours. She caught his hand and pressed it sharply, uttering a quick remonstrance. "Don't say that. I know, but I can't hear you say it. It's too terrible. My boy, food has choked me many a time when I have thought of the possibility of that. Now take that old lounging chair by the fire, and if you are too tired to talk, we will just sit and rest together." He sank into the depths of the big leather chair with the lion's heads on the arms, where he had sat so often in the days when his feet did not touch the floor, and he was half afraid of the grim monsters cut into the polished wood. That chair seemed to speak to him of the things long forgotten. It was like the touch of an old familiar friend. He felt a sudden yearning tenderness for the happy little boy who had sat there and dreamed of the big world so long ago. Alas, he had been dead many a summer, that little boy. He sat looking up at the magnificent woman beside him. He had almost forgotten how handsome she was, how lustrous and sad were the eyes that were set under that serene brow, how impetuous and wayward the mouth, even now, how superb the white throat and shoulders. Ah, the wit and grace and fineness of this woman! He remembered how proud he had been of her as a boy when she came to see him at school. Then, in the deep red coals of the grate, he saw the faces of other women who had come since then into his vexed, disordered life. laughing faces with eyes artificially bright, eyes without depth or meaning, features without the stamp of high sensibilities. And he had left this face for such as those. He sighed restlessly and laid his hand on hers. There seemed refuge and protection in the touch of her, as in the old days when he was afraid of the dark. He had been in the dark so long now. His confidence was so thoroughly shaken, and he was bitterly afraid of the night and of himself. "Ah, mother, you make other things seem so false. You must feel that I owe you an explanation, but I can't make any, even to myself. Ah, but we make poor exchanges in life. I can't make out the riddle of it all. Yet there are things I ought to tell you before I accept your confidence like this. I'd rather you wouldn't, Will. Listen, between you and me, there can be no secrets. We are more alike than other people. Dear boy, I know all about it. I am a woman, and circumstances were different with me, but we are of one blood. I have lived all your life before you. You have never had an impulse that I have not known. You have never touched a brink that my feet have not trod. This is your birthday night. 24 years ago, I foresaw all this. I was a young woman then, and I had hot battles of my own, and I felt your likeness to me. You are not like other babies. From the hour you were born, you were restless and discontented, as I had been before you. You used to brace your strong little limbs against mine and try to throw me off as you did tonight. Tonight you have come back to me, just as you always did after you ran away to swim in the river that was forbidden you, the river you loved because it was forbidden. You are tired and sleepy, just as you used to be then, only a little older and a little paler and a little more foolish. I never asked you where you had been then, nor will I now. You have come back to me. That's all in all to me. I know your every possibility and limitation, as a composer knows his instrument. He found no answer that was worthy to give to talk like this. He had not found life easy since he had lived by his wits. He had come to know poverty at close quarters. He had known what it was to be gay with an empty pocket, to wear violets in his buttonhole when he had not breakfasted, and all the hateful shams of the poverty of idleness. He had been a reporter on a big metropolitan daily, where men grind out their brains on paper until they have not one idea left, and still grind on. He had worked in a real estate office where ignorant men were swindled. He had sung in a comic opera chorus and played Harris in an Uncle Tom's Cabin company and edited a socialist weekly. He had been dogged by debt and hunger and grinding poverty until to sit here by a warm fire without concern as to how it would be paid for seemed unnatural. He looked up at her questioningly. "I wonder if you know how much you pardon." "Oh, my poor boy." "Much or little, what does it matter? Have you wandered so far and paid such a bitter price for knowledge and not yet learned that love has nothing to do with pardon or forgiveness, that it only loves and loves and loves? They have not taught you well, the women of your world." She leaned over and kissed him, as no woman had kissed him since he left her. He drew a long sigh of rich content. The old life, with all its bitterness and useless antagonism and flimsy sophistries, its brief delights that were always tinged with fear and distrust and unfaith, that whole miserable, futile, swindled world of Bohemia seemed immeasurably distant and far away, like a dream that is over and done. And as the chimes rang joyfully outside and sleep pressed heavily upon his eyelids, he wondered dimly if the author of this sad little riddle of ours were not able to solve it after all, and if the potter would not finally mete out all his comprehensive justice, such as none but he could have, to his things of clay, which are made in his own patterns, weak or strong, for his own ends. And if some day we will not awaken and find that all evil is a dream, a mental distortion that will pass when the dawn shall break. Thank you.
Eleanor Roosevelt was quite a woman, and she always had a lot to say. Fortunately for us, she wrote some of her memories about Christmas at Hyde Park to share with others. My name is Julie Oliver, and I'm going to read to you Eleanor Roosevelt's Remembering Christmas at Hyde Park. When our children were young, we spent nearly every Christmas holiday at Hyde Park. We always had a party the afternoon of Christmas Eve for all the families who lived on the place. The presents were piled under the tree, and after everyone had been greeted, my husband would choose the children old enough to distribute gifts and send them around to the guests. My mother-in-law herself always gave out her envelopes with money, and I would give out ours. The cornucopias filled with old-fashioned sugar candies and the peppermint canes hanging on the tree were distributed, too. And then our guests would leave us and enjoy their ice cream, cake, and coffee, or milk, in another room. Later in the day, when the guests had departed, my husband would begin the reading of A Christmas Carol. He never read it through, but he would select parts he thought suitable for the youngest members of the family. Then, after supper, he would read other parts for the older ones. On Christmas morning, I would get up and close the windows in our room where all the stockings had been hung on the mantel. The little children would be put into our bed and given their stockings to open. The others would sit around the fire. I tried to see that they all had a glass of orange juice before the opening of stockings really began, but the excitement was so great I was not always successful. Breakfast was late Christmas morning, and my husband resented having to go to church on Christmas Day, and sometimes flatly refused to attend. But I would go with my mother-in-law and such children as she could persuade to accompany us. For the most part, however, the children stayed home. In later years, I went to midnight service on Christmas Eve, and we gave up going to church in the morning. I remembered the excitement as each child grew old enough to have his own sled and would start out after breakfast to try it on the hill behind the stable. Franklin would go coasting with them, and until the children were nearly grown, he was the only one who ever piloted the bobsled down the hill. Everyone came in for a late lunch, and at dusk we would light the candles on the tree again. Only outdoor presents like sleds and skates were distributed in the morning. The rest were kept for the late afternoon Christmas tree. Again, they were piled under the tree, and my husband and the children scrambled around it, and he called the names. At first, my mother-in-law did a great deal of shopping and wrapping, and the Hyde Park Christmas always included her gifts. Later, she found shopping too difficult. Then she would give each person a check, though she managed very often to give her son the two things she knew he would not buy for himself— silk shirts and silk pajamas. These she bought in London, as a rule, and saved for his Christmas, which to her was always very special. In the early years of our marriage, I did a great deal more sewing and embroidering than I've done since, so many of my gifts were things I had made. The family still has a few pieces of Italian cutwork embroidery and other kinds of my perfectly useless handwork. I look back, however, with some pleasure on the early Hyde Park days, when I would have a table filled with pieces of silk and make sachets of different scents. I would dry pine needles at Campobello Island and make them into sweet-smelling bags for Christmas. Now I rarely give a present I have made, and perhaps it is just as well, for what one buys is likely to be better made. Each of the children had a special preference in gifts. When Anna was a small child, her favorite present was a rocking horse, on which she spent many hours. Later she was to spend even more hours training her own horse, which her great-uncle, Mr. Warren Delano, gave her. One of the nicest gifts we could possibly give her as she grew older was something for her horse, Natoma. Jimmy loved boats from the very beginning, whether he floated them in the bathtub or later competed with his father in the regattas of toy boats on the Hudson River. Elliot was always trying to catch up with his older brother and sister, but because he was a delicate child, I think he read more than the others. I remember that books and games were very acceptable gifts for him. Franklin Jr. and John were a pair and had to have pretty much the same things, or they would quarrel over them. They had learned together to ride and to swim, so gifts for outdoors sports were always favorites of theirs. My children teased me because their stockings inevitably contained toothbrushes, toothpaste, nail cleaners, soap, washcloths, etc. They said Mother never ceased to remind them that cleanliness was next to godliness, even on Christmas morning. In the toe of each stocking, I always put a purse, with a dollar bill for the young ones and a $5 bill for the older ones. These bills were hoarded to supplement the rather meager allowance they had. When I was able to buy sucre d'orge, barley sugar, I put that in their stockings, together with some old-fashioned peppermint sticks. But as they grew older, this confection seemed to vanish from the market, and I had to give it up and substitute chocolates. The stockings also contained families of little china pigs or rabbits or horses, which the children placed on their bookshelves. The children themselves could probably tell much better than I can the things they remember most about these years, but I know that all of them have carried on many of the Hyde Park Christmas traditions with their children. Today, some of my grandchildren are establishing the same customs, and my great-grandchildren will one day remember the same kind of Christmas we started so many years ago.
Ho, ho, ho. This is the Bad Santa, Tom Haines, and I'm here with my friends Kurt Benrood and Angie Callahan, and we're going to read The Yule Fairies, a Winter Solstice Story. A group of little fairies huddled in their home deep under the roots of a giant oak tree. They were safe and snug in their tiny underground cave lined with dandelion fluff, bird feathers, and dried moss. Outside, the wind blew cold, and the snow fell softly down to cover the ground.
I saw the Sun King today,
the fairy named Rose said as she pulled her mossy cloak tighter about her.
He looked so old and tired as he walked off through the forest. What is wrong with him?
The great oak said he's dying,
answered Daffodil.
Dying? Oh, what will we do now?
Little Meadowgrass started to cry.
If the Sun King dies, our little plant friends will not grow. The birds will not come and sing again. Everything will be winter forever.
Lilac, Dandelion, and Elder Blossom tried to comfort their friend, but they were all very sad. As they huddled together, there was a knock on the tiny door.
Open up, fairies,
called out a loud voice.
Why are you hiding inside instead of joining us in our solstice celebration?
Rose opened the door, and a little gnome, Brown Nobby, pushed inside, shaking the glistening snowflakes off his brown coat and hat.
We are too sad to celebrate,
Daffodil said, wiping her eyes.
The Sun King is dying. Haven't you heard?
He is dead, you silly fairies.
Brown Nobby's round, dark eyes sparkled with laughter.
Now hurry, or we'll be late for the celebration.
How can you be happy and laughing?
Elder Blossom stamped her little foot and frowned at the gnome.
If the Sun King is dead, it will be winter always. We will never see the sun again.
Silly little child fairies.
Brown Nobby grabbed Dandelion by the hand and pulled her to her feet.
There is a secret to the winter solstice. Don't you want to know what it is?
The fairies looked at him in surprise.
Secret?
They all said.
What secret? We are only new little fairies, you silly gnome. We've never been to a solstice celebration before.
Come and see. Come and see. Get your capes and come with me.
Brown Nobby danced and jigged around the room.
Hurry, hurry. Don't be so slow. To the sacred oak grove through the snow.
He danced out of the door and disappeared.
What did that gnome mean?
Rose asked as she gathered up her cloak of dried rose petals held together with cobwebs and lined with goose down.
I don't know, but the lady lives in the sacred grove.
Meadowgrass pulled on her hat.
Perhaps if we go see the goddess, she can explain what Bobby Nobby was talking about.
The fairies left their snug little home and trudged off through the snow toward the sacred oak grove. The forest was dark with only the light of the moon shining down through the thick fir branches and bare limbs of maple and hawthorn. It was very difficult for them to get through the snow because they were very, very small. As they waded through the wet snow and shivered in the cold wind, they met a fox.
Where are you going, fairies?
The fox asked.
To the sacred grove.
They answered. They were cold and shivering.
Climb on my back, and I will take you there swiftly.
The fox knelt down so the fairies could climb up. Then he raced off through the dark.
Listen,
Lilac said as they neared the grove of sacred trees.
Someone is singing happy songs. A lot of someones.
The beautiful music carried over the cold, still, moonlit air. It was the most beautiful music the fairies had ever heard. The fox carried the fairies right to the edge of the stone altar in the center of the grove, then knelt down.
Look,
said Elder Blossom as they slid to the snow-covered ground.
There is the maiden and the mother and the old wise crone, and many other little people.
They're all smiling and happy,
said Lilac as she looked around at all the creatures.
All the animals are here, too,
whispered Dandelion.
Why are they all looking at the mother?
The fairies moved closer to the three ladies seated on the altar stone. The mother held a bundle close in her arms, smiling down at it. The maiden reached down and took the fairies gently in her hands. She held them close to the mother so they could see what she held.
A baby!
A new little baby.
Look how he glows! He is the new sunborn king,
said the maiden, smiling.
But Brown Nobby and the old oak tree said the Sun King was dead,
the fairies answered her.
How can this little baby be the Sun King?
That is the great secret of the winter solstice.
The old wise one touched the baby's cheek with her wrinkled hand.
Every year the Sun King must come to the sacred grove during the darkest days of winter where he dies. I take his spirit to the mother who gives him new life again. This is the way for all creatures, not just the Sun King.
You mean everything lives and dies and lives again?
The fairies looked down in wonder at the baby Sun King nestled in the arms of the mother.
Yes, little ones,
answered the wise old crone.
There is never an end to life. This is the great mystical secret of the winter solstice.
The fairies laughed because they were so happy.
I think the little Sun King should have gifts,
said Rose.
I will show him where the wild roses bloom in the early summer.
And I will teach him to call the birds and listen to the songs of the wind,
exclaimed Dandelion.
When he is older and stronger,
said the mother,
then the flowers will bloom at his touch, and the birds will return to sing their songs, and the air will be warm from his breath, and winter will be gone for a time. Then the Sun King will run and play with you in the forest.
The little fairies sang to the baby Sun King songs of the coming spring, the sweet-smelling flowers, the bumbling bees, and all the secrets of the forest. And all the creatures within the sacred grove sang with them. Then the fox took them back to their snug home under the roots of the giant oak tree, where they dreamed wonderful dreams, waiting for the warmth of spring and the fun they would have with the little Sun King.
This is Matthew Wood, and I'll be giving you the feminine point of view about Santa Claus with Why Women Would Love to Be Santa Claus, and newsflash, Santa Claus is a woman. But first, why women would love to be Santa Claus. First, you'd never be expected to make the coffee. Secondly, there'd be no more early morning decisions about what to wear to the office. Third, you could grow a gut the size of Guam and consider it a job requirement. Fourth, the one big black belt could accessorize you for the rest of your life. Fifth, should people suggest your belly jiggled when you laughed like a bowl full of jelly, you could hit them with your purse. Sixth, you'd always wear sensible shoes. Seventh, there'd be no need to play office politics. A hearty ho 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 would remind everybody who's in charge. Eighth, no one would dare ask you for a ride to work. Ninth, instead of the glass ceiling, the only thing you have to worry about is a narrow chimney. No more trips to the vending machine. You just snack on milk and cookies all day. You'd never grab the wrong coat on your way out the door, and you would know that things without a doubt, all the clothes, shoes, rings, and things given as gifts this year would be the right size. When you get your next white hair, that'll be par for the course, and you'll be looking forward to the next one. Newsflash. Santa Claus is a woman. Believe me, there has been eons of cover-up surrounding Christmas, and more specifically surrounding the revered figure of Santa Claus. All pictures of Santa show a male figure rotund in shape with white hair and a full snowy beard. His job depicted is keeping a list of not only who is good and bad each year, but what they want for Christmas, and ensuring each gift is handmade and then delivered all over the world in one night. Well, I'm here to blow his cover. I've discovered, without a doubt, that Santa Claus is a woman. Think about it. No offense to my many male friends, but do you know any man who would keep up with the behavior of all the children of the world and what they want for Christmas? This right here eliminates Santa as a man for most people that I know. Most men I know wander around a mall one day a week doing some power shopping for the one of two gifts they're responsible for. So the idea of any guy planning ahead and making gifts all year long is clearly ludicrous. Guys, I know this is crushing. Who wouldn't want to be Santa? This Christmas icon whizzes through the skies at high speeds, then rappels off a roof, dropping down a chimney, and of course eats a lot of cookies. I admit these activities sound slightly more masculine, perhaps, but I'll admit that the public image of Santa makes it easier to believe this favorite Christmas character is male, but I am sorry. Planning Christmas parties, family gatherings, thinking about creative and loving gifts, shopping for everyone from kids to teachers, baking hundreds of cookies, wrapping presents, writing cards to everyone we've ever known to wish Merry Christmas to them, and delivering gifts for the past 25 years, I have reached the stunning conclusion that it's all a cover-up. So after doing the Mad Christmas Dash once again and loving it, I am here to be the first to break the story that Santa Claus is a woman and his sleigh is a minivan.